Recently on the show, we talked with WBUR reporter Martha Biebinger. You might remember she was trying to shop without buying any plastic, and she found it incredibly hard to do that. That was part of WBUR's Cooked newsletter on sustainable eating, and that conversation with Martha kind of put plastic front of mind for us here at Radio Boston. So imagine if we could modify the genes in a bunch of different plants and then string those together to make a better plastic, something that would be plasticky when we needed it to be plasticky, but then would actually biodegrade when we're done with it in a way that plastic right now doesn't. Of course, there's also this other question, which is imagine the ethical implications of being able to do that. What else could you do with that technology? Well, we can ask because Chris Prather is the Arthur D. Little Professor of Chemical Engineering at MIT. She's imagining all of that in her lab, and she's here in Studio 2. So, Chris, welcome.
Thank you very much.
So I'm going to start with the big picture. What is the ultimate end game here, Chris? What are you trying to do?
Great. So let me start. First of all, I have to say, I love the word plasticky. I'm gonna keep
it's
that.
It's yours.
And I'm going to use it. I'll give you attribution for it, but I'm going to use that. The ultimate goal here is twofold. One is to actually recognize where you started with, which is that plastics have done such a large impact on our lives. It is very difficult to imagine our life without them, even if you understand what the potential ramifications could be of having them persist in the environment. They are useful. They are beneficial, and we can't easily get rid of them. And so if we start from that premise and say there are things that we really need that have this function of a plastic, then the question becomes, how do you mitigate the damage that's done if they persist in the environment indefinitely, if they accumulate in the oceans and things like that? So our end goal here is to try to still give us those materials, those plastics that are plasticky when we need them, but to pre-design them, if you will, such that at their end of life, they are much more environmentally responsible and they can go back to where they came from, which is back into the soil, back as carbon that can be used to then fuel the growth of new plants that can give us new materials.
And you do that through what's called synthetic biology. Interestingly, we had a synthetic biologist on the show yesterday, but still, tell us what that means, synthetic biology.
So synthetic biology, my joke for that is always, you can ask five different people what it really means. You'll get at least six different definitions. But the definition that I like is that this is really about engineering biology, using biology, meaning living things, as a platform or a substrate for new design that give us new functions. Okay, so what does that mean in the context of what we're doing? Well, we start by asking, where does the stuff come from that gives us these plastics? Plastics are what are known as polymers. Those polymers are composed of monomers, and overwhelmingly, those monomers come from petroleum. They come from oil and other oil-derived precursors. So our objective is to be able to produce the same functionally equivalent materials, but in a way that allows us to take advantage of biology, which is by definition and by nature renewable and sustainable.
So living things and using living things to create this new plastic?
Exactly, using living things. And the living things that we use are microbes, microorganisms, especially bacteria. But there are people who do this with yeast. You can think about the yeast that's used to bake bread or yeast that's used to brew adult beverages. Those organisms can all be engineered using synthetic biology, where we can change the DNA that's contained within them to allow them to produce new molecules. We can then isolate or purify those molecules and then use them to make these materials that we need as plastics.
So this feels like a double-edged sword because it also sort of sounds like a Frankenplant, right? And when you do that, we know that genetic engineering has controversy behind it.
It does.
So what are you wary of and what are the ethical concerns that come up for you in
your
work?
Sure. So I will say for us, I'll put it this way. One of the big concerns always about anything that's genetically engineered is about its release into the environment. Okay, and especially given that our objective is to try to mitigate damage to the environment as much as possible, one of the things that we're always cautious about is, what is it about these organisms that we're creating? Are we making things that are more or less likely to escape? I'll put that into air quotes, even though your listeners can't see the air quotes. And what's their potential to do harm and to do damage? So the case is that most of what we engineer, these cells are not very happy. We engineer them in a way that they really like to live in the stainless steel vessels that we put them in. They don't like to escape and live in a natural environment because they're so changed from what they were before that they can't really survive. But we also have to make sure that on the engineering side, the process engineering side now, that we have appropriate safeguards in place so that we don't have accidental release and accidental exposure. So we have a little bit of the advantage in that what we are engineering is going to be contained. What we're producing from that is separated from the genetically engineered organisms. And so we are able to have a little bit of a shield there. But you mentioned earlier that people are also looking at plants that you would grow in the ground and having those be engineered to produce plastics and materials as well. And the same sorts of concerns come into place, which is how do you actually have containment? How do you make sure that you're not going to disrupt the natural ecosystem by what you're adding in that's been engineered?
But you always do, right? So, there's a piece of me. I'm going to dumb down this conversation for my end for a second. I'm thinking Jeff Goldblum, first Jurassic Park. Mm-hmm. Oh, the dinosaurs can't reproduce on their own. And he says, nature finds a way, right? When you make changes like this, there's always going to be some fundamental change that gets out there, isn't there?
There will always be fundamental changes. But what we have to remember is that we've done this throughout the recorded civilized history or domesticated agriculture. Okay, so what we've done, if you look specifically at plants, what we've traditionally have done is to take different breeds and to crossbreed them in a way that if you look at, there are these wonderful pictures that you can find that looks at what did a corn stalk or a maize look like back in the early 1600s, and what does corn look like now? And you would, if you came from a different planet, you wouldn't actually recognize those as the same species, because they have been engineered in a way that we actually are now purposefully breeding different species together in order to give us something new.
So give us a couple of examples where this kind of synthetic biology to solve a problem has already been done safely and successfully.
Oh, sure. So one example I love actually comes from the lab where I was a graduate student. This was at the University of California at Berkeley with Jay Kiesling. And the problem that they were addressing was that malaria is a disease that's endemic, especially in Africa. And there was well known to be a plant natural product, meaning almost think about it as brewing a tea, but something you could extract from plant leaves that actually was very effective in curing malaria. However, availability of the drug was very limited, both because it's difficult to cultivate very large amounts of the plant, and it was also very much subject to seasonal variation. So if there's a drought, there's no plant. If there's a flood, there's no plant. So what the Kiesling lab did was to say, we know that the plant that makes this compound has DNA in it that will give us that ability to produce it in something else. So they engineered a strain of yeast, similar again to what you may have from having a fermentation of wine, to produce this chemical compound. It was much more scalable. It was much more reliable. And that then allowed them to say, and they worked with pharmaceutical manufacturers to do this, to say we have a consistent, reliable supply of this drug that actually is going to be used to cure a really terrible disease, which is malaria. So that's an example of the kinds of thing that the technology can do, which is to allow us to have more ready access and more reliable access to all sorts of compounds that have a real direct and beneficial impact on human life.
We're talking about using synthetic biology to make a better kind of plastic. We're speaking with Professor of Chemical Engineering at MIT, Chris Prather. So I want to bring this home now. A couple of weeks ago, we did an interview with an author who talked about the history of Kendall Square, Chris, MIT Kendall Square, and how it attracts great minds and builds new industries. And we know synthetic biology is an industry that's coming up in that area. So you go from UC Berkeley, you come to MIT. What's possible in your research here because of the ecosystem you find here?
Oh, this is such a wonderful question. This area is so vibrant and so alive with people who really want to make a difference. People who want to use their talents, their intellect, their resources, their collaborative spirit to identify problems, real problems that we're facing in the world, and to actually figure out how do we try to solve those problems. I think what's really wonderful about the Kendall Square atmosphere is this opportunity to have wonderful connections between those of us and academic research labs and those who are actually in the commercial space or the industrial space.
And you've spent time in that space.
Oh, I have, yes. I actually worked in industry for 4 years before I came back to MIT as a faculty member. And there are certainly different approaches that we have to solving problems. But what's undeniable is the fact that we in academic labs need to be able to translate what we do into the commercial space if it's going to have that impact. If I have this wonderful discovery and all it ever does is make the people in my lab happy because we've found something new, that's not actually bringing benefit to society. And we actually need help to do that. We need to be able to rely upon the resources, both intellectual resources and the financial resources, to be honest, of a much broader ecosystem to help us to do that. And I have to say, even just, I say to people all the time, just sitting, not so much since COVID, I have to say, but I used to love sitting in a restaurant in Kendall Square and having lunch and being a little bit early and waiting for my lunch partner to join me, because just not eavesdropping per se, but hearing the conversations that are happening around you are just so intellectually enriching and stimulating that it really does emphasize what a unique ecosystem we live in.
So how's the research going?
Oh, it's slow, but it's exciting. Research. I always tell my students it's called research because you search and then you search again.
You research.
And you search again and you search again. But we're moving forward. We're making progress. We're doing this. You mentioned this ecosystem. We're doing this with collaborators who are experts in actually building materials, where we focus on the synthetic biology part. And we're making progress. And every sort of aha or eureka moment that comes from a student or postdoc working in the lab really reemphasizes for us the significance of what we're doing and the impact that it can have on the world. And that's really wonderfully exciting.
And the dream for when I'm, you know, drinking water out of a plastic bottle that was genetically engineered from corn.
Are you asking me to put a timeline on
that? Yeah, I am.
You know, I always say if I could see the future, I'd have bought a lottery ticket and I probably wouldn't be here talking to you. I'd be on a beach somewhere. We're making progress. It's coming. I would say it's on the order of years, not decades, but it really is going to take a concerted effort. There's a very large entrenched industry that also has to get behind this movement, and that's starting to happen as well. So I'm optimistic, but I'm not gonna give a shortcut and give you an exact timeline for that.
That's all right. That's fair enough. When you get further along, will you come back and tell us about it?
I'd be thrilled to do so.
Fantastic. All right. MIT researcher Chris Prather telling us about the latest development in synthetic biology right here in Massachusetts. Her lab is the Prather Research Group at MIT. Chris, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.